Welcome to On the Couch, a podcast from Reaction with me, Lucy Beresford, broadcaster and psychotherapist, taking a deep dive into the relationships making the headlines in politics today and exploring the psychology and personalities in political life. In psychological terms, money and finances represent emotional supplies, which is one of the reasons why issues like the cost of living crisis or specific topics like the amount of money that energy companies make attract attention from people who aren't actually even really interested in politics. They tap into a very human fear of scant resources and safety. So in a week when interest rates have gone up again, and a Rishi Uffal designed in particular to rev up the economy engine took place, I am delighted to welcome my man with the spreadsheets, business editor and columnist for The Spectator, Martin van der Weyer. Hello, Martin.
Hi, Lucy. Thank you very much for that nice intro.
Well, very nice to have you lying down on my couch, as they say. It has been quite an interesting week with regard to issues around money and energy and things that really tap into, as I say, the things that even non-political anoraks are very interested in. We had this new department created for energy security net zero. We saw trade and business very explicitly linked with Kemi Badenoch as the new business secretary. Can I start off by asking you, what did you think of those elements of the what I'm dubbing the Rishi Uffal this week?
Rishi, I've now got it. Rishi Uffal. Okay. Nice one. What do I make of that? Well, not much. I mean, do you think the voter is the slightest bit interested in that, or even particularly aware of those personalities? I am not sure what is the rationale for splitting what was previously called BAYS. That sort of slightly awkward pronounced acronym. Other than the fact that, of course, energy security and net zero, although sometimes in conflict with each other, are two very, very important long-term objectives, which could easily be separated from the day-to-day civil service work of kind of trying to help promote British exports and that kind of thing, which one assumes is what the business department does. So bureaucratically, there's probably some logic. If he actually brings energy security and net zero up the agenda, that's probably a good thing. So what's happened in the last couple of years, energy security came up the agenda, net zero went down. Maybe harnessing them side by side, you know, gives a better balance. Who knows, frankly? I don't really know about that. And Kemi Badenoch, I know slightly because she used to be a colleague at The Spectator, and she seems an admirable, feisty, sensible, plain-speaking person. So I'm pleased to see her advancing, but I wouldn't bet the general public knows her, knows anything about her. I think the most important element of the reshuffle was to get Nadeem Zahawi, you know, out of the headlines and parked, really. So that's been done. And the only interesting thing from a media point of view is this sort of very, very plain-spoken right-wing sort of red wall kind of Tory Lee Anderson coming to the fore as deputy chairman. Well, that's, you know, throwing some red meat to his end of the party. He seems quite entertaining, at least.
You know? And he has certainly dominated the headlines over the past 24 hours. Sort of the death penalty is now all that anybody is talking about.
Right. Greg Hands, is that he's the new chairman, isn't he? Well, I've met him. He's sort of ex-city, like you and I. He used to trade in something somewhere, I believe. And he's an amiable fellow. But again, the public don't know him from Adam.
So. But this is the thing, isn't it? So what you're really drawing attention to is the fact that, most of the electorate, and let's say the 50% of the electorate who are less engaged than most people, they won't even be paying attention to this. So it won't, they feel, really impact on them, apart from the fact that there is there is an optic here, isn't there, with the reshuffle having been so technocratic, so boring in a way, that it was very much about, you know, just having different departments. Do you think it helps at all in terms of how the electorate regards the government or regards Rishi Sunak, who, as you know, like some of us, is ex-City, he's ex-Goldman's? Is it important, therefore, that this is his territory, this is exactly his turf? He wants to be seen as economically competent. He wants for his worldview to be recognised as being about the economy and being about business. And is that actually going to help with the electorate? Will they look at that and think, yeah, you're a safe pair of hands?
Well, I think Rishi, as Chancellor during the COVID, depth of the COVID period, was seen as a benign figure and a safe pair of hands. Benign in the sense that pretty well everything he did was extremely helpful to people who were suffering through COVID. The furlough scheme, the business support loans and all of that, they were very rapidly and efficiently rolled out. They worked, they, you know, they glued the economy together through a very difficult period, and he looked good at that stage. But I don't know what you think. I think political memories are incredibly short. So now he's being judged entirely on how he's doing in the, you know, is it 100 and something days he's been prime minister, and he's not making much impact. And being economically competent, of course, is his selling point. But what do the public want from a prime minister? They want kind of statesmanlike grandstanding about Ukraine. We got a bit of that, and then Boris tried to upstage him yesterday, perhaps did upstage him. We or they, I mean, the voters apparently put top of their list that they would like the, you know, immigrants in small boats issue addressed. That's not really Rishi's natural territory at all. So although, what do I think about him, you know, being an alumni of Goldman Sachs and all of that, I think quite clearly he is economically literate, numerate, understands money, has made a bit of money for himself, never mind his wife's fortune, is a very sensible guy to have his hands on, you know, the levers of the Treasury and the UK economy, alongside a very technocratic Chancellor in Jeremy Hunt. So that ought to reassure people. But again, are they really interested? Or, you know, is attention focused on these issues which he can't readily solve? Plus, people just feel poor and put upon, you know, they've got less money to spend than they had before the pandemic. They see strikes everywhere and so on. They see the country fraying at the edges, to say the least. And they're taking a sort of dim view of the government, because that's what you do when you feel like that. And every event that happens, like a reshuffle, I don't think is ever seen as positive, is it? I mean, I can't remember back to Thatcher reshuffles, whether they were seen as time after time, the muscle, the command of Thatcher being exercised and bringing on new talent. Reshuffles now are seen as defeats, i.e. could he have hung on to Nadeem Zahawi? Why didn't he go a bit quicker? Who are these new non-entities that we don't recognise that are now in these top posts? So it's another step towards a Keir Starmer government, in effect, that Rishi's on the back foot having to reshuffle because he has to lose someone who had become quite high profile in Nadeem Zahawi.
And so as you say, there are these things that he has sort of done that might not really seduce the electorate. But what would seduce the electorate, presumably, is a lowering of interest rates, which, of course, we can't have because we've only just had them raised in the last week. And maybe something very specific around energy companies, because we've had Shell and we've had BP both announce their profits in the last week. What do you think? Well, for a start, do you think that 4%, the rise to 4% of the interest rate, do you think that's likely?
That's a Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee decision. It is not
Yes, but Rishi Sunak actually talked about it as being one of his five pillars. And as you say, that's actually not necessarily within his gift.
It isn't in his gift at all. What he can mean by that is somehow to manage the economy to a point where the Bank of England can comfortably start bringing interest rates down. We're not actually seeing that ahead now. What we're seeing is one or two more quarter point rises. Why? Because the domestic elements of inflation are still quite hot. The global elements of inflation have cooled. And we're still in a phase where the economy needs to be restrained in order to suppress domestic inflationary forces. So so on energy, the fact is there was a lot of energy bill subsidy support going into the system. There's now going to be a bit less, but people do overlook the fact that the bit less happens as we get into the spring and summer when people can turn their heating down. And the situation is not going to be as bad as it was forecast to be. Nevertheless, the public finances, they tell us, and I believe them, they really can't afford to do much more. So could they really cane the energy companies to make everyone feel a bit better? I think that's where you were going with that question. Yeah. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the fact is the UK generated profits of energy companies are now really pretty heavily taxed. And the only way to offset those taxes is for them to invest a lot more in, UK energy security, which we've already referred to. But that does mean bringing on more carbon-based fuel, as much as it might mean bringing on more renewable projects. So windfall taxes are a device to appease angry voters. They're not most people who think hard about how to tax business would say they're not a good thing in principle, because they introduce an element of politics and deep uncertainty into an area where what you want is as little politics as possible and long-term reasonable certainty for the purpose of capital investment. If you're thinking about investing in a country which is capable of suddenly whacking on an extra tax because your profits have gone up, and you're in a very volatile industry where your profits can vary very widely, and everyone can see your profits have gone up because global prices have gone up. You haven't done anything exploitational, really. You're just still operating.
Or even clever or innovative.
Market. You haven't either positively or negatively created the situation. It's just that the market has generated a super profit for you. Well, okay, government can intelligently take a slice out of that, so long as they're giving good capital relief for new investment in the right direction. But if big profits, so between Shell and BP, they made £55 billion last year. That's pretty, eye-watering stuff. But to just come in after those announcements, say, we'll have another slice of that, thanks very much, even though vast proportion of it comes from their exploitation of oil and gas reserves elsewhere, not in the North Sea, not in the UK, and so on. I mean, it's a bad taxation policy, but you can see why the government would try to do it to appease the angry voter. But I think this government probably thinks it's done it as much as it can, so it can't do any more. But, the voters will chunter away saying, it cost me, what's a litre of diesel is now in 1.69, something like that. It was over £2, so it's come off 40p, but it's 40p higher than it was, in recent memory. And so looking up at a big green BP sign above the petrol pump, you sort of curse BP. Of course you do. But, that's just the market at work. And I think
You sort of do, but something that you and I've discussed in the past is the way in which, the companies like Shell and BP might be creating some really healthy returns on people's pensions, that actually what people, the angry voter, as you characterize them, might say, this looks really unfair, this company is making lots of profit, and it goes to the investors. Well, quite a lot of those investors are pension funds.
Yeah, this is all true. I don't know what proportion of Shell and BP are held by UK
pension funds, yeah, funds
and UK savers, but it is the significant side effect of those profits is that bigger dividends will be paid and the value of those shares will hold up or rise a bit as they have done and so on. That's all to the good, but the general public doesn't connect those two things ever, really. You know, if supermarkets look as if they're whacking their prices up, yet, you know, pretty well every middle of the road investment portfolio in the country would have some Tesco or some, you know, Sainsbury shares or something. No, people just don't make those connections, do they?
Well, unfortunately, they don't, because it's about the pound in your pocket, not about the pound in your future pension fund, if you were to have one. And of course, not everybody does have one. And that goes back in a way to this idea that ultimately the next election is probably going to be fought around the idea of whether people feel poorer or not, to use your phrase of earlier. I was going to say in the session, but this isn't a therapy session, but this sense that what people, well, it might not be
working wonders for me.
I'll send you an invoice later. The idea though, that already. If you don't feel that you can live the life that you had, say, a year ago, and we're maybe so sensitive this because of the pandemic that we spent a lot of time thinking, oh, my life is so different to how it was before. And now we're having to do that from a financial perspective as well, which, as I have said earlier, it can feel very, well, it is genuinely scary. If your energy bills have tripled in the last 6 months, or your mortgage rates have increased, or perhaps the fixed rate that you're about to sign up to is, you know, double what it was last time, then that's a genuine concern. Am I actually going to be able to survive? And the government, as you say, becomes the whipping boy for that. So what does the government need to do, do you think, from to cover that domestic element of the inflation in particular, because inflation is one of the biggest worries. Yes, there is a war in Ukraine component, and yes, there might be a productivity component, but are we talking now about something that could be done for small businesses, or is it more down to the individual level, do you think, that the government needs to operate at?
Well, there's a budget coming up. It's highly unlikely that there'll be any significant personal tax concessions, because, you know, they've told us when Kwarteng and Liz Truss went out the door and everything they had attempted to do went out the door with them, we were told that, you know, now the way taxes are going to go is basically up. And in order to rectify the fiscal position we've got into because of COVID, especially we're having a period of relative austerity with personal taxes. And I don't think there's anything they can do about that. And if there was anything they could do about that, would it make any difference to whether they can win an election within 2 years? So if you're doing it purely on political calculation, you might say, well, we're likely to lose this election, and there's very little we can do to turn that around. Tax giveaways now would be just like Liz and Kwasi again, who crashed the markets and, you know, disgraced their party and embarrassed the country. So we can't just do that again. We should stick to our line. But what intelligently could a government do now that would ease the situation? Well, I suggest they could certainly revisit corporate tax generally. I think it's a mistake to whack corporation tax back up from 19 to 25%, which they're about to do. It's probably a mistake. They took away something called the super deduction, which was a big capital allowance for capital investment, that was a very well-received measure. It was temporary, but they could have extended it. They could do various other kinds of things to encourage areas of business they'd like to encourage: artificial intelligence, bioscience, you know, robotics, all this stuff. They could adjust VAT rates for sectors that are struggling. Hospitality is one which really benefited from a VAT cut during COVID, and that if they brought that back and so on. But if you wanted to be really brave, you might say, well, hang on, why don't we ease immigration, run completely counter to the sort of Suella Braverman, you know, Home Office view, and say, well, actually, what this economy needs is to loosen up the labor shortage problem by letting in software coders from the Baltic states, fruit and vegetable pickers, where, you know, from Romania, wherever they come from, slaughterhouse workers, wherever they come from, categories of hospitality worker that are in short supply, building and construction. I was talking yesterday to a group of fit out specialists for big office blocks. So they're everything from designers to the guys who fit the sprinklers, who are specialist trade. And they're short of everybody, and their wage rates are going up, and the completion dates are going back, and the contracts are getting more contentious because the things don't show up. They can't deliver, you know, ease that problem, add some, you know, lubricant to sectors of the economy that are suffering. But of course, you can't see them doing that, really, can you?
Sadly not, because it conflicts, as you say.
Get some more superficial measures that are just hoping to sort of buy in, win back floating voters to make the election result closer than, you know, the wipeout it looks like it might be.
I'm going to lift for my final question directly from a brilliant article in The Spectator today, written by one Martin van der Weer, to ask you, what comfort can we draw, or maybe what comfort can, the nation draw from this extraordinary thing last Friday, whereby the FTSE 100 was at an all-time high of 7905. It seems very counterintuitive to all of the economic messaging that we have had for the last 6 months. What was behind that? And yes, could that be Rishi's saving grace? And by extension, obviously, the happy voter.
Well, so that certainly isn't Rishi's saving grace or saving his bacon. He probably isn't a big consumer of bacon, but it doesn't really help him much at all, except that, as I have written, it plays to a current kind of maybe short-term narrative of gloom receding. So we've had a number of things. We think inflation probably peaked, general inflation probably peaked at just over 11% in October and has come down to 10 point something, maybe 9 point something, we'll see next. We think interest rates, as I said, will peak in one or two more monthly rises. Some consumer figures, hospitality sector, I also looked at this week, is doing a little bit better than they thought they might. West End of London retail footfall and spending is a little bit better than, you know, so Doomsters said it would be.
That's all down to Valentine's Day, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I think. Yeah, no, yeah. I'm a very, very big spender ahead of Valentine's Day myself. Stand by for the delivery. where was I going? Yeah, so a slightly shallower recession. Well, so the stock market is reacting to all of that, so it's a bit perkier because of all of those things, and it is generally looking forward 18 months, 2 years. Often the stock market is thinking in medium term terms rather than immediate short term, what's going to happen next. So that's all generally, you know, of a piece, you can say. But actually within the FTSE 100, something like 80% of the revenues of the companies are global. They're international. They're not UK domestic. And 13%, I think, by market cap of the FTSE 100 is energy companies. We talked about them. They're having super profits. Their shares have stayed strong. You know, banks are looking a bit stronger. for no obvious reason. House builders are looking a bit stronger. That is an indication looking a couple of years ahead. If you want a little bit of history, think back to the 70s. I was just starting work in the city. You were at Toddler Group, possibly, or not even there. There was, you know, a terrible economic crash. The winter of 73 into 74 was a Labour government, very, very high taxes, global recession, oil prices went spiking upwards, crippled the economy, and so on. The stock market crashed right down low. The FTSE, or its equivalent then, went down to sort of three-figure number for some time. And then sometime around January 1975, so really a long time before the actual economic recovery, which is, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years later, the stock market turned. There was some anecdote about the Queen Mother meeting her stockbroker at a shooting weekend and saying, you know, when is the stock market going to turn? And he gave her a load of economic stuff. And she said, well, I'll pray for it. And she prayed for it. And on Monday, it started going up.
Where is she now?
Saying, I don't think the all-time high of the stock market does the slightest good for the government, but it does just play to the current mood of things are not bad, quite as bad as the gloomiest pundits said they were going to be. And my personal view is that by the second half, most of this year will still feel tough on consumers, very hard on people who are really pushed at the bottom of the social and economic scale, let's be honest. Not too hard at all on the middle classes, actually. I think they'll be fine. They'll be in the restaurants and booking the Ryanair tickets. And by the second half of next year, it'll all look quite a lot better, barring some other ghastly, you know, black swan intervention, a war or a virus or something else. So in the run-up to the general election, the economic mood could be quite a lot better. But the interesting question is, can that make a blind bit of difference to a government that's now looks terminal? You know, I mean, just looks beyond rescue.
Past its sell by date.
As you know, you think back to 96, 97, the economy was really doing fine in the mid-90s. Ken Clark was a very good chancellor, came out of recession. We had a period of stable growth. Ken Clark and Eddie George at the Bank of England, very competent economic management, but they were doomed, you know, and they'd been doomed since either, whichever way you like to look at it, the fall of Margaret Thatcher or Black Wednesday in 1992. They were never going to recover. But actually, in fairness, it was a period of good government and strong economic recovery. So there wasn't a real economic reason to throw out the Tories in 97, but they were always going to lose.
Can I just ask an addendum question, though, which really will be my last question? But you mentioned that actually bank stocks had been part of that all-time high in the FTSE 100. And I was thinking back to something else you'd written recently about what really needs to happen in certain communities is a resurgence, if you like, of the high street, and that it, or of the town centres, that it needs, you know, local shops, and it would be great if every area could have a good proactive vicar, but it also needs a bank, that it needs a, yeah. So I'm not asking you to opine on the Church of England, that we could save that for another day, but yeah, the idea of a high street bank, that the face of the economy that could start to be a relationship that the voter, angry or otherwise, could start to feel heard and seen and maybe loved.
Well, that's a whole interesting area of discussion, really, about what is the relationship between bare economic numbers like the growth rate or the inflation rate or the level of wage rises and real quality of life individually and collectively. So collective quality of life, I think, is very strongly influenced by the structure and fabric of the community in which you live. I, part of the time, live where I'm speaking from now, Helmsley, small market town in North Yorkshire with a population of just over 2,000 people. Pretty well every amenity. We haven't got a decent dispensing chemist. That's a very vital thing, actually, but we haven't got a decent one. You know, we have got a small theatre and cinema because I built it. We've got a good Indian restaurant. We've got an Italian restaurant. We've got several pubs. We've got three active churches. We've got 2.5 GPs. We've got a fire engine. We haven't got a police officer, and we haven't had one for about 30 years, but then we haven't really got any crime. but what I'm saying is we've got a tight-knit, well-provided small community. It's very neighborly. The cost of living quite well in a place like this is relatively low. There's a high level of volunteerism, for example. So all of that's really important, and it's more important than bare statistics about inflation or growth. And to make that happen in any community, can be a small town, could be a suburb, could be a, you know, some part of central London. You do need all these things that I listed. A post office. We haven't got a post office here at the moment, and that's a damn nuisance. It really is a nuisance, and it's annoying. You know, and you feel a loss of a basic amenity. We nearly lost the library, but they said, oh, you can keep the library if the volunteers will take it over. So we, you know, it cuts the county council costs by, you know, £30,000 a year or something. So we you know, we did that. Banks. Do you need banks? The banks themselves would say, well, you, the customers, have proved you don't need them by taking your banking online. Largely, you'd hardly use cash anymore. We could have a branch open, but our cashiers would sit there for hours every day with nobody to talk to because people don't use them. Well, it's not quite like that because, first of all small businesses are still, to some extent, cash handling and need to be able to pay in. That's a very important thing in any community. Secondly, you need people who lend money. That's what banks do. They take it in as deposit and they lend it out. And they, of course, lend on mortgages, and that can be done entirely online. But for lending to businesses, you need a bank manager who actually knows the territory, knows the business people, and can make judgments. And so I was irritated by Bank of Dave. Don't let me put you off watching it because it's mildly entertaining. But it made a complete fairy tale of all of those issues. If you want a much more prosaic example of, you know, decent community banking, lending to small businesses, answering the phone when you ring, it's called Handelsbanken, and it's Swedish, and it has 200 and something branches in the UK. It generally hires ex-managers from Barclays or NatWest or HSBC who've had no power to behave like bank managers for years and years. And they Handelsbank says, go and open a branch somewhere. There isn't one in Helmsley, but there is one in the district. Go and open a branch somewhere. Here's our sort of operating manual. You decide who to lend to, what rate, what margin, you know, over base to lend to them. And off you go. And it's a very, very successful example. And I hope it goes on growing. I've just seen this last week some pretty good figures for their growth. So it does happen, it does exist, and I think it does make a difference. And in every well-knit community, it would be good to have a bank that lends and helps small businesses with their cash and, you know, can solve your problem if you need to talk to a human being.
So let's keep it local is what keep you're saying. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But then, you know, that's totally against the trend. There's meant to be a project to create banking hubs where all the banks would combine in one little premises. And I don't know how they do it, but it ain't rolling out at any speed.
One for a future podcast, I think. Or if there are any bank managers listening, perhaps they could get in touch and explain why they're not doing that. Martin van der Weyer, business editor and columnist for The Spectator. Thank you very much indeed for being on my couch.
Very good. Thank you.